メリークリスマス、ミスター・ローレンス。
Hello, this is Father Christmas, Martin Kessler, and for your present, I spare your lives. You're listening to FlixWise Canada, and I'm joined by two returning guests, Leanne Kubich and Zachary Curl. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
That's good.
For the purposes of this podcast, you can refer to me as Strafer Zach.
Strafer Zach. What is a strafer?
I'm a soldier's soldier. Yeah, I'm a podcaster's podcast.
There we go.
And I don't have a nickname because there's really not any women in this movie, so, yeah.
No, you're...
That's hard, yeah.
Well, thank you for braving this film full of men and this podcast. I'm looking forward to hearing what you have to say about the film.
Yeah, I didn't even think of that. That's, like, especially interesting to hear a woman's perspective on a film completely full of men.
No, I honestly love this movie a lot. Watched it many, many, many times, and I have to say it's one of those ones that goes on the shelf forever, you know? It's good stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I almost buy it again all the time, too, which is a weird compulsion of mine.
I haven't upgraded to Blu-ray yet, so I'm trailing behind, but I bought it twice on DVD, so that's... one of those... But it's not quite what you might think it is on first glance. You know, if you just see the poster or read the description, it's kind of hard to get an impression of what the film is without actually seeing it. You know, you see the poster and it's like, David Bowie kind of looks like Lawrence of Arabia. Is he going to be Lawrence, like, causing trouble in the camp? And like, no, it's not that. And then is it going to be this, like, forbidden love? And it's kind of, but not exactly. It's sort of... almost several different things, but I kind of like that it's a very difficult film to pin down. I don't know if you have the same impression of it.
No, I mean, I find it an interesting thing because it's definitely like, you know, your war film, World War II, we have, you know, thousands, it seems, of films like about that at this time, but it takes a very different way of looking at it. It's not about valor. It's not about, you know, who's right and who's wrong. It's about everybody's wrong. And it's kind of about love or unrequited love in a way. So that's why it's so unusual.
Right.
Yeah, I think I totally agree with that. I look at this film and it's, I think like a lot of Oshima films, it has that, like, you could try to sum this movie up in a couple sentences, but also it's not anything about that. Like, you could write a paragraph trying to describe this movie in like a single sentence. And I completely agree with Leanne that this movie is so much about love to me, and like that love can happen in these kind of awful, impossible circumstances as well. And without getting too much into the movie yet, but seeing the relationship between some of the characters and some of these things that you have this sense of everyone trying to almost make the best of these situations and trying to forget for a moment they're at war, that they're prisoners and still have those kind of relationships or those moments together.
Right. I mean, the sort of pair of relationships you get between the Allies and the Japanese, one's the sort of relationship between the David Bowie character, Strafer Jack Selliers, and Ryuichi Sakamoto's Captain Yunoi. And that feels like very much unrequited love. And then the other relationship you have, it's between the Tom Conti character, who's the titular Lawrence, and the Takashi Kitano character, the Sergeant Hara. And that's, it's more like a friendship that could have been if they weren't at war. I mean, both pairs of relationships, it sort of strikes me that like all the war, all the kind of cultural differences get in the way of people who actually have maybe something in common or some connection.
I think that there's also a third relationship, is even what the film starts out with, between Kanemoto, the Korean soldier, and Dijon, the Dutch soldier. And, you know, they talk about it several times throughout the film. Are they gay? Was this assault? Was it like, but no one is able to actually explain what it is and say, like, I'm not gay, but he was very nice to me and he was very tender to me. And this was I think these are themes that are kind of only, they're trying to make the point that these are things that only happen in these kind of situations at the same time.
And it's also interesting that they don't have the words, because it's 1942, so they didn't have the words for I'm gay or I'm not or I'm just, you know, because he said that he was tender, I kind of think it wasn't an assault situation, that they're just saying that to get out of get out of trouble. So that's why it's so interesting, because you didn't have those words back then. So they didn't even know how to describe how they're feeling. So that's another reason why Yanoi is like, well, he's bugged out for a lot of reasons, but he doesn't have words for what he's feeling.
Right. I mean, the Yanoi character, he's maybe the one that comes across the most conflicted, where he's so formal, and even just the way he's framed, like he's, you know, I think of that shot of him at the desk when he's going to berate the Takashi Kitano character for letting them free. But you always get the feeling that, like, right under the surface, there's something about to crack with him, and then he does kind of crack when he's about to bring that sword down on David Bowie after he kissed him on the cheek, and he just can't bear to do it. Like, some of those shots I think of where it's just like a close-up on his face, and you can see him struggling to keep his composure, and I find that aspect of that character really compelling.
I think that Oshima does that really well early on. In the first scene where we see Jack in the courtroom, what I believe is the prosecutor speaking, and Yanoi, just like, we're essentially getting his perspective, where, you know, the prosecutor's voice is basically getting softer and softer, and it's just this swelling, beautiful music as he's just staring at him. And this is like, we're literally seeing like how he's feeling, like right in that moment. And like, we've all had that moment of just being like infatuated with something, or like you're so fixated on something that everything else is being tuned out. And I think that was a really interesting and really beautiful like introduction to that relationship and that how he views him.
And I think it's interesting too, because it's pretty obvious that Yanoi is like an Anglophile, or he's studied, you know, English at some point, because he knows a little Shakespeare and he even practices it. So he's obviously like emboldened by Sellier's. He sees this very unusual guy and he's like, ooh, maybe I can, you know, get in on there and we can talk. And even though he's a prisoner of mine, I can, you know, practice my English. We can talk, or maybe, and then he finds out that that's not going to work. But he's obviously like, something there is like, oh, I can finally be myself a little bit.
Yeah. I think the whole film is filled with those kind of offhand connections like that. Like even their camp, Yanoi practices kata in what appears to be like a former missionary. Like if you look at the architecture around everything, it looks like it was repurposed from, it's definitely Western, which means like it must have been imperial in some way, or like I said, like a missionary of some kind, and then taken over by the Japanese to keep Western soldiers in.
Even the scene where the David Bowie character has been buried up to the neck, when Captain Yanoi goes in, the way he cuts off a piece of his hair, there's something like a little bit like fetishistic I found in just like him taking some of the blonde hair, and then he gives him a bow and a salute. Like he doesn't quite know how to articulate his feelings, so he falls back on this sort of formal expression, but it's like you can see him struggling to connect with him even in that moment, and he just doesn't quite even physically have the way to communicate that.
Yeah, I think that's in a lot of ways the difference between Yanoi and Hara. Yanoi very much seems to be towing the line. He is an officer 100%. Like he believes in this war, he believes in what he's doing. For Hara, he is, to him, it's simply a job, I think. And like he feels pretty much like a soldier. And we see that kind of mirrored like in the final scene of the film, with the first time we see Jack, the same way, where Jack doesn't understand why he's being held on trial. He's a soldier, he was doing what he was told. And Kitano's Hara character feels the same way at the end when he is saying, like, I understand what's happening, but I don't understand why I'm being punished for it. I was just doing my job in that same way. And Yanoi to me is a person who very much believes in what he's doing. And then these new feelings for him are in a way challenging everything that he is. and he doesn't quite know how to make sense of that.
No, absolutely, absolutely. I think, well, I mean, Memento Mori was much more, you know, regular back then, people keeping hair of a dead loved one or what have you. Mm-hmm. So in that way, I was like, well, maybe he's just keeping it as a, like, a, you know, keepsake. But also, I mean, there were people would keep, like, I mean, battle, you know.
Trophies.
Yeah. And unfortunately, that could have been part of it. Like, you know, because, you know, he is a top, you know, ranking officer and all that sort of thing. So, you know, possibly. Both, I think, actually, which is kind of creepy, but, you know.
There's so much samurai imagery in the film, too, and so much, you get so much a sense of how Yanoi pictures himself to be and sees him in himself this samurai spirit, and a samurai taking another samurai topknot is a symbol of conquering them and defeating them, and I think you could even look at it in that way, like, of him finally saying, like, I've conquered you, like, whether it's romantically or, you know, one of the other soldiers refers to him as an evil presence trying to steal his spirit. Like, to him, he could also be like, you almost ruined me, you know, you almost made me become something that I wasn't supposed to be, and I've conquered you now.
That's an interesting point about the other soldiers who were trying to, like, intercede on his behalf to save his soul, so to speak. And that's a very Eastern idea. You know, it's like a collectivist thing. We all help each other. We all work together as a unit. And yet on the Western side, you don't have that happening. Like, nobody's saying to Celliers or something, you know, nobody's trying on the other side to stop any of the of what, you know, Celliers is kind of, you know, does his own thing, to say the least. And so you would think, like, somebody would be like, let's stop him or let's stop somebody, but there's none of that.
Yeah, you could look at it too of, like, you know, coming back to, like, the soldiers don't see anything wrong with it in the same way, and, like, they're very much like opposing viewpoints going back and forth throughout the entire film. But I think even more than that, Lawrence's relationship with Celliers, when he talked to him, he said, I think he's taken a shine to you. And he keeps kind of, they're aware of Yanoi's infatuation with him. And I think that there's kind of a few points in the movie where you can see Jack being a little cheeky with that and really, like, I can get away with this, or I can stop him from hurting other people because he loves me. And I know the kind of power I have over him. And he's a little more bold than otherwise he would be.
And he's naive, too, to think that he could break the cultural barrier, like, in, especially when you're in war. So you still have all these, you know, totally different cultures coming together. And then you have war, which just screws everything up. So his idea that he could tease him and, oh, you know, I'll get away with it, did backfire spectacularly, you know?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's interesting, too. Like, in the flashbacks for the Celliers character, you see him standing aside while his younger brother gets picked on and bullied, and that's the sort of collective, they're all going to pick on this kid and I can't go against it. And it's such a shameful thing for him. You see him carrying that, and it's like he's trying to, in some ways, make up for that.
Yeah. I mean, I think that nostalgia has a huge, it plays a lot into this film. I think that, you know, us getting those kind of flashbacks from Jack really kind of put him in a place that you're a little more aware of, like, how he presents things. I know that sounds very broad, and that's what, like, character development is supposed to do.
They really do feel like this isn't quite a flashback to what the reality was. This is his memory that you're watching, you know, when he's buried up in the sand, and that's when it goes into a flashback, and you're going into his head, and there's sort of an unreal quality to it. You have these, like, bright blue lights coming in for some scenes, and the fact that for a large portion of the flashbacks it's just adult David Bowie playing a high schooler, you know, it sort of adds this quality that, like, it's a memory that you're watching. It's not just a depiction of what happened.
I think it was very poignant in a way, because, I mean, he's, you know, he didn't ruin his little brother's life, but he definitely messed it up really badly by, you know, he never sang again, and he just kind of became, he didn't continue in school or anything because he was so ashamed. And he's making up, I mean, in his mind, this is the only way he can make up for, you know, doing what he did to his brother by helping his, you know, military brothers, you know?
Oh yeah.
And that's very beautiful, and but it's so very tragic because he can't say, his brother will never know. And, you know, his sacrifices, it doesn't mean anything. you know, because his brother doesn't know he did this and it doesn't benefit his brother. So,
yeah. And I think a lot of the flashbacks, I think to kind of point out what you were saying, Martin, of it being funny of him playing, you know, a teenager, I think it's, I think that there's more to that in terms of, it's mostly his brother always being the same age. And I think that these, the way that Oshima built these memories of like, this is how he's always going to remember his brother. And he's always going to see the him now presented in that. So we are getting specifically, like, I think this was the first time I watched a film where that felt like an actual memory to me. Like when I think back as a child, I think of adult me. Like when I have any kind of self-actualization,
it's difficult to actually recreate.
Yeah.
Like the exact. Yeah. Yeah.
And even in the final flashback isn't even a flashback so much of, it's like almost like a dream. It's a regret, you know, like we know that he never saw his brother again after his wedding. We know that everything that he's told us about him, we know that that scene can't be real, because the last time he saw him was at his wedding. And then when war came, he just left. And we know that his brother obviously wasn't that age when he got married. We know that his brother never sang again. We knew all these things. And I think that that kind of last moment of his life was just of like, I wish that I could have done this again. And I wish that this moment would have existed, you know, and I wish I also could have made good on that promise that I always wanted to make too.
I think that's right. Yeah.
What I find interesting though, is why is Celio is the only one who gets a flashback. I mean, I had read that they filmed one for Tom Conti's character, and it's that story he tells about the woman he meets and then he's like, doesn't want to tell anymore. So apparently that was filmed and that was cut, but why is there no flashback for Yanoi? He is Sellier's counterpart. It's kind of, I always found it a very strange, like diversion, sort of jarring diversion in the film that you only have a flashback for the David Bowie character. Like,
It does feel unbalanced in that way. And it also feels like Sellier's flashbacks inform Yanoi's character as well. You know, like that scene where Yanoi first sees him and he takes off his jacket. David Bowie takes off his jacket and you see the marks on his back from being beaten and whipped or whatever happened to him. It's a lot like, you know, when the younger brother has his shirt taken off in the flashback and you see he's got a hump on his back. And like, there are these little connections like that, that sort of, when you rewatch the film, especially, it feels like those flashbacks don't just inform the Sellier's character. They inform the film as a whole.
Yeah. And also it would lose the mystery of some of that film too. In this, I think part of the film is really wondering like what he is thinking all the time and like, what are his motives? And I think that having more of his backstory and flashback, you'd be like, oh, that's what it is. And I think part of the beauty of this film is he's in a way sometimes like the audience, where he's in the moment and where we only know what we know kind of thing. And his development is being told throughout the film rather than in getting it in the backstory. And I don't know, have you, I think you could also kind of view the film as the entire film almost as Hata's flashback before that final scene, that everything is, we know that everything's building to that scene, especially on like, you know, the watching it more than once, you know, at least to me, that's the moment that always sticks out the most to me in the film. And when I think of that movie, I think of Kitano's face saying that final line. But you know, if I don't know if you, either one of you guys read Corto Maltese at all.
I have not yet, but I will.
It's really great. His most famous story is called The Ballad of the Salt Sea, and it takes place around World War I on this island in the Pacific. And you know, there's war going on, there's a bunch of other things happening, and without, you know, actually telling what the film or what the book is about, like it kind of ends on this oddly nostalgic note of like, this was a time that, you know, was going to be over, and when I think back, I'm going to think back about this. Like it's oddly sentimental, and I think that this film has that same kind of feeling of like, things were horrible and things, you know, we were at war, but at the same time we were kind of in a little moment of peace throughout everything else, and other things happened. And he gets to look back at that and, you know, remember that night where I was so drunk and I got to be Father Christmas. Like,
right.
We're seeing that kind of beautiful moment through him, in a way.
Right. I read somebody's review, and they interpreted it as, like, he was trying to bring up that memory to somehow get off the hook, like, get leniency from the death penalty in that final scene. But, like, I don't think it reads that way at all. It's so sincere.
Yeah, I wouldn't.
You know,
think
like
that
you
at
said,
all.
That look in his eyes. Yeah.
When he says that he's ready to die and he's not afraid of death, like,
yeah,
I totally believe it.
I believe that.
And especially seeing Kitano's later work, like, you can, you know, you can look at him and see that, you know, the nihilism in his face, I think, in the same way. And that's what makes him such an effective actor in this film.
It's so bittersweet because he's saying goodbye to, like, a good friend. I mean, they were friends. And that's the messed up part. Because, I mean, especially we were talking before about, you know, how there's not a lot of information. I mean, especially how the movie just starts. It's like Java, 1942. There's a lizard. And then, you know, Mr. Lawrence is getting beaten by Hara. So it just starts like, boom, here we are. I'm beating the crap out of you. And we're going to talk later. And we're going to be, like, friends. I mean, it's just... he's constantly getting, you know, Lawrence is constantly getting beat, like, all the time, and he's still having these lovely conversations with Hara. So it's like, yeah, it is, they have a friendship, and there is something good to look back on, but wow, what a messed up friendship, what an abusive, and it's not their fault. It was war that did this to them.
Yeah, I feel, and I think that Hara only sees this as a job. Like, I may have to beat you, but I don't know why that means, like, I don't think that means we can't be friends.
Yeah, and that's so sad, because they could have been friends in any other circumstances.
Hara also comes across genuinely open-minded whenever they're having these discussions. Like, he'll tell them right to his face, to Lawrence's face, I'd admire you if you killed yourself.
Yeah.
You know, because he sees it as shameful being a prisoner, but then Lawrence sort of retorts that, well, it's only so that we can go on fighting you, and it's actually courageous. And you see Hara kind of take that into consideration. And
there's no cynicism between the two of them. There's no irony.
No.
Like, Lawrence could completely write him off and be like, you don't get it, but he actually explains to him, and I don't know if in the book they explain it, but you never really see exactly how he's captured either. And, like, we know obviously that he knows a lot about the Japanese at this time in the film too, because he lived there, he knows their language as much mm-hmm. as, you know, he can, and he almost seems like a camp counselor in a way, but, like, you would believe it if they said, oh, he wasn't a prisoner, he just worked there as well.
Well, it's interesting, like, there's the Captain Hixley, the other...
Mustachioed guy
who, like, is sort of technically in charge of the PLWs, but Lawrence, in some ways, has more authority because he can speak Japanese and because he can kind of make himself useful for the Japanese, and you can see him sort of riding that line in a lot of situations in a way that I find is very interesting. Like, I mean, one thing that is sort of hinted at in the film is that when Selyers shows up and he's talking about how great of a leader Selyers was, because he knew him from before, the Captain Hixley thinks that he wants to replace him with Selyers basically as the de facto leader for the PLWs.
Yeah, it's funny, like, he just constantly thinks he's like, oh, you think you're so smart, huh? Like, you think that you're gonna beat me. Like, he's just constantly on edge all the time. And
which school did you go to?
Yeah,
Winchester.
yeah
I mean, he's still holding on to, like, his past, like the British class stratification, and there he's still holding on to that in prison camp. Like, it makes no sense. Like, he's, you know, I mean, of course you need to keep some sort of order in an army situation, but his whole, like, you know, aristocratic or what have you whim or airs are just so silly, especially when he does his little trot stomp thing.
Yeah, I've been thinking about that whole thing. Yeah, it's so comically British and royal and, yeah.
Well, that's actually, speaking of just funny British, I mean, watching Tom Conti act, and as he gets physically deteriorated through the film, it's mm-hmm. such a brilliant acting job, because he's, like, all floppy, and it could be incredibly funny. When you're watching it, it's like, wow, this is kind of funny, but it's not, because he's getting beaten, you know, the crap beaten out of him every 2 seconds, and he really keeps this very sort of line of not being completely tragic. It feels very British, and it makes me think of some of his comic acting, but yet there's a line there that he straddles very, very well.
But it I think that also plays to like his whole mystique about where does he come from kind of thing, because he's very clearly not a soldier the way that Jack is a soldier. And he's very clearly not a soldier like the other commander as well. Like, he is a very, very different person than the two of them.
Well, even like Jack Sellier's, I wasn't even sure what nationality he was. Like, I think there are these people from different nations kind of swept up between these two empires. The Dutch soldier, like, you sort of feel in some ways the reach of the empire just by the people fighting there. And then, of course, on the Japanese side, you have the Korean guards, they mention.
It's interesting to point out that the Korean soldier also has a Japanese name, too. Whether or not he is specifically referring to him as Korean, even though like he's of Korean descent, but is also Japanese, or has been living in Japan, and he has a clear delineation of who is Japanese and who is Korean, because of course we also know about, you know, Japanese race politics around that time too.
Like, you can be like third or fourth generation Japanese and you're still Korean, so
yeah
it could be that, you know, they don't specify necessarily.
If you've seen Death by Hanging, another Oshima film, he also touches on Japanese Korean racial politics and tensions in that as well, and it wouldn't be too far-fetched to see him kind of carry that into this film as well, or just be something that he is constantly thinking about in his personal life, as Nagisa Oshima is also a pretty strong critic of Japanese society overall.
Sure. I mean, you can definitely see that in the film. It's you know, pretty critical of imperialist Japanese values and culture. And I think that's true, but like a lot of his themes and ideas kind of carry over from one film to the next. Like, if you go through his filmography, a lot of times you can almost see the kernel for the next film in the preceding film. Mm-hmm. Have either of you seen his last film, Taboo?
Yes.
No, I've honestly, I'm one of those people who've only seen like this and In the Realm of the Senses, so I'm, yeah, okay. I know. Not a great background on that.
I think you would probably like it. It's it was the first Oshima film I'd seen, but it's about the taboo of homosexuality with samurai, and Takashi Kitano is also in that.
I think it's interesting. Do you guys find it interesting that, like, basically three out of the four main characters are amateur? Well, Bowie, you could make the case he wasn't an amateur actor, but Ryuichi Sakamoto and Takashi Kitano, both, that was our first film. They weren't really actors. And I think it actually helps that they're not, and that their like dialogue is somewhat shaky at times, because it makes it more natural, because they're so sort of nervous at times. I mean, obviously Tom Conti did not speak right. Japanese, but he memorized everything perfectly. So,
yeah, I love the shakiness of Ryuichi Sakamoto's like line reading sometimes, of him stuttering over words, and you really kind of get the impression of it's you know, a guy struggling to find the English counterpart of his actual feelings at the same time.
Again, it sort of gives you this feeling that there's kind of a gap between the person he is on the inside and the performance he's giving as this camp commander. And like, I think it's so interesting just the makeup on him.
Yeah.
Like how can you get the impression like that's makeup that character gets up in the morning and puts on, you know, the perfectly trimmed hair. Like, it, you know, he's so focused on presentation, but there's something.
Yeah.
You get the sense that that's not who he really is, which I think makes it very, very effective. And I mean, it's interesting he does the soundtrack too, which I think is very memorable.
I think that was like his rider, basically. Mm-hmm. Like, he told Oshima that he would really only accept if he also let him do the score, because this was his first time ever scoring a film. And he really wanted to do it.
Do you guys like the score?
Oh, I love it. It's beautiful.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I got it for Christmas on vinyl. Like, I got that new, like, Mondo Records one for Christmas a couple years ago.
Right.
I love his music. I mean, I love YMO. That was one of the draws for me for this film. I actually came to this film through Kitano, because I was obsessed with him. You know, I saw Hanabi while I was in school and became, like, overwhelmingly obsessed with finding like everything that he was in and everything he had done. And then when I saw that Ryuichi Sakamoto had done the soundtrack, I was, like I said, already a huge fan of YMO. And so I was like, I'm in. I'm doing this.
I mean, he's done like a lot. What he did, The Revenant. He did The Last Emperor. A lot of different soundtracks. So I know him through that. But what I think maybe the reason he has like, you know, makeup, it was the early 80s. He was a pop star at the time in Japan. So I'm wondering, like, did they want to make him look a little like, I don't really know what his, I didn't see any of his music videos or anything like that. But I'm wondering if they wanted to, because it's weird. It's like you have two of the biggest pop stars of their age in this movie together. Not a glamorous movie at all. But Sakamoto is given the pretty makeup and David Bowie is not given anything. So it's almost like it, but yet when we see it, like, I really wonder what the reception was over in Japan. Like, were they like wild? Like, were people going like wild over this because, like, you know, a really big comedian and a really big pop star was in it? Did they care that Bowie? I mean, they must have like liked Bowie a bit and known who he was, but it did not seem to get the same reception on the West, where people who are, unless you're like a really obsessive Bowie fan, you don't know what this is. So I really wonder in that regard, like, did they do it just to appease Japanese audiences?
I have a Takashi Kitano book where there's a really good interview with Oshima about how he did the casting. And he talked about, I guess he had liked Bowie for a long time, I guess. And he was in Japan filming some commercial for Japan. And he knew someone on the crew. And he's like, ooh, ask him if, tell him I said hi, kind of thing. And he wrote him a letter asking him to be in a movie for him. And then Bowie was just like, I guess he had already seen some of Oshima's films and really liked Death by Hanging, which was, like he said, was wonderful for a Westerner. Like, he's different from other Westerners. And like, Bowie was basically like, yeah, come see me. And he said, it was very difficult for me to get a plane ticket. And he went over and they kind of just like hit it off. And he was like on board right away. And I guess he had known Takashi from like doing variety shows. And apparently he said he gave him two bits of advice for filming you should do movies. And he said, don't settle for a small role and don't be in a comedy, because he could sense that there was like a darkness about him that he's like, that's something that you can only really see in certain comedians and certain people. And like, he saw that in him. And it was kind of just by chance afterwards that he cast him in this as his first acting role.
I mean, it doesn't play like Sun Casting when you watch it. It doesn't feel like, oh, here comes the pop star. Like, going back to just the contrast between the makeup and like David Bowie not having any, like, I think of that moment when he, David Bowie's trying to escape with Lawrence,
mm-hmm.
and he lifts up that sword and he's sort of just pointing it out on the way, like, you know, I feel like most people would. And then,
you come for your rug, I presume, line.
Right. Yeah. The you know, and then Yanoi, when he pulls his sword out, it's like so graceful, and it's like somebody who's just practiced it nonstop. And you know, you see the character practicing the sword earlier in the film, and it's just this complete contrast between disheveled Bowie, who's got stubble and he's sort of shaky with the sword, mm-hmm. and the Ryuichi Sakamoto, like, looking perfect, like absolutely, you know, sort of picture perfect. And the soundtrack kind of feeds into that, because it just, you know, it's not the kind of classic orchestral score you're sort of used to for these types of films.
It's just, it's really dreamy in so many ways.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that, right, you could even look at like maybe Sakamoto's makeup too. Like, I'm not trying to prove my thesis too hard here about this maybe being like Hara's flashback, but like, you could kind of read that as like, this is his vision of Hara, like this upstanding samurai like commander. And Hara obviously respected him very much. It even says in the end, it's very sad that they executed him. And like, throughout everything, he had a lot of respect for him, even if he disagreed with him or if he didn't understand his motives all the time. Oh, and sorry, one more bit about the casting stuff, I guess. I do remember reading like a while ago that Kitano said that he was hurt very much by the final scene of the movie. You know, him being mostly known as a comedian, I guess during the final scene of the movie, audiences in Japan just burst out laughing because they thought it was supposed to be a comedic scene because it was him. And he, you know, very much meant it in the serious way as possible. And I think a lot of people watching it abroad and people making the film understood the emotion behind that. And he was, from what I understand, very hurt by initial reception to it.
Wow. That shows like that in a way that the audience was only seeing the comedian and they weren't, because you know, I mean, I've never seen any of his comedy bits or anything like that. I only know him like this and on like Outrage and things like that. So I only know of him as like this sort of very, very dark and sensitive man. But I, you know, I don't think of him as a funny guy. But this was also pre accident too. Before he had that motorcycle accident. So his face is still quite like round. It doesn't have that massive scar. So yeah, I mean, I can understand why if they were looking at him, because sometimes when I'm watching this, I'm seeing David Bowie and then I'm thinking like, wow, Let's Dance came out the same year as this movie. And it just, that doesn't make any sense to me. Like I was listening to the album the other day, trying to see if there's any like connections. And I'm like, there's not, there's nothing.
I love looking at that, like that album cover, any of this like promotion around that. Like the first time I saw it, I was like, oh my gosh, I bet he made that while he was making Mr. Merry Christmas, Mr. Like he has, still has the same blonde hair and the same haircut. And I'm like, I feel like, you know, like Russell Crowe in Robin Hood, you know, where like, I always feel like he got that call from Ridley Scott. And he's like, hey, you want to play Robin Hood? He's like, I did just get my haircut, you know, and it's like the classic Russell Crowe haircut. And he's like, it's cool, we'll work around it. Like, audiences will buy that, you know.
That's funny. I don't know if they're directly connected, but the film I sort of not associated exactly because they're pretty different. But the Mishima film, A Life in Four Chapters, came out I think the following year.
Yeah, I always kind of see the film as very interesting pairs as well. I for some reason I think maybe I just saw them close together too, but it seemed that blend of Eastern and Western influences to make like a pretty, like they're both like very visually unmistakable and very like idiosyncratic films.
Yeah, I always think of this one with like the Thin Red Line because that also takes place in the Pacific during the war. And it's like these people who are in a beautiful place and yet it's disgusting. It's hell because of war and what they've made it. And you know that, you know, otherwise it'd be like a beach. It'd be really nice and beautiful, but they've destroyed it all. And that's, and they have a very, you know, similar tone. Like, well, this has like a no valor. There is no glory to war. I mean, there's like an inkling of that in the Thin Red Line, but you know, you definitely get the tragedy of it all. So those are the two that's the one that this makes me think of most.
Yeah. I think you could even like, have you seen Sonatine, Leanne?
Oh man, it's been a long time. But yeah, a while back.
Oh, with the stuff on the beach?
Yeah, that same kind of thing of like this reprieve from war, this reprieve of violence, and just kind of acting like children in some way. And like, you know, especially Kitano's character in Sonatine, of just like his very grim sense of humor and like him, like this different side of him kind of coming out and playing in this kind of paradise while they essentially just wait for the other shoe to drop. I feel like, again, like that memory aspect of Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence, of like somehow, you know, if any of them survived, maybe they were nostalgic for that moment, you know, where they look back and they see this. I don't know.
Or just like any of the decisions where, you know, they could have some gesture of love, or they take some gesture of love and in return offer violence, you know, like it's sort of that quality, like, you know, you could be nice to each other, this could be paradise, but instead we're gonna ruin it, you know. That's sort of the impulse, which I think makes that scene where Celliers goes up and kisses Yanoi on the cheek like really remarkable, because it seems like they're about to have some big like violent confrontation, you know, the way he walks and the music picks up, and that seems like what Yanoi almost thinks is going to happen, but you know, he shoves him back, and then the David Bowie gives him the double kiss in the cheek, and it's like that kind of a gesture is what causes him to break down.
He was totally prepared for violence, and he was totally prepared for any kind of confrontation, and in that way of like suppressing of his feelings, and he was ready for any of that kind of thing. But then the moment Celliers did that, it was almost like a moment of, you know, release, you know, just like, I don't know, almost like sexual in a way. Well, obviously, but like, you know, it was, he was just not, I think that's almost always what he wanted. And then it happened in a way too.
Right, and then it happened in public, which is the worst possible thing that could happen, right. And that's why he has to retaliate. Like, he has no choice. It's that or his honor and his life, so...
And we even see with, like, the other Japanese commander coming in and saying, like, I am not as nostalgic as Captain Yunoi was. You know, I'm not as sentimental as Captain Yunoi was.
It's like, wow. That's pretty sentimental, man. Wow, yeah.
But, yeah.
Early on, it sort of feels like that whole situation with the Dutch prisoner and the Korean guard, like, that sort of sets the stakes, where one's forced to commit suicide and the other, I think, bites his tongue and then swallows on it and to kill himself. So, you know, you really do feel like the stakes of two people loving each other in this situation, it's life or death.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think, like, even... So, like, saying, like, setting up for, like, war crimes, you know, there's moments where or that moment where they make all of the infirmed prisoners come out, and you say, like, you can't do that, that's against the Geneva Convention. And that's just, like, you can see Sellier's as Yanoi's, like, downfall in that way too. Like, he's not only is he, like, making him question himself, like, he's doing things that he knows are wrong, and he's doing things that are essentially, you know, war crimes, because he's trying so hard to suppress these feelings that he has for this person and just overcompensating them with violence.
But one thing I like about this film is that in some ways it's a film about forgiveness and friendship and love. And, like, that's not the sort of obvious approach when you have, like, hey, it's going to be a POW film. It's going to be about resistance, and it's going to be about, you know, sort of all these other things that, it almost feels like a reflex when you make a film like that, that you just assume, oh, these are what the themes are going to be. And I like how Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence just breaks away from any of that.
Yeah, exactly. Like, none of the prisoners, the Allied prisoners, are like, let's make a prison break or let's try to revolt or anything. They're just like, we're here and we're really sick and we're just going to kind of try to survive this, you know. And you don't usually see that in a lot of just people being stagnant and staying and being and not rebelling against it. So that in one respect is very interesting, that they're just like, no, let's just keep it as regular as possible, which is ridiculous when you're in a war situation, but that they tried it. See, that's what keeps pushing back in this war situation, is their regular cultures, where they're like, no, let's try to keep it regular. But it's like, you're not in a regular space. War is not normal.
Right.
Yeah. And even, I think, like, the second to last line in the film with Lawrence visiting Hara, when he says there are times when victory is very difficult to take. This is one such moment. He, you know, recognizes Hara's crimes and understands, like, why he needs to be punished. And at the same time is still, you know, lamenting the loss of a friend, and still thinks of him fondly and as a good person. And I, you know, you can almost just think of those, you know, those conversations they had where they both earnestly spoke and listened. And I think that that's something that when you're outside of immediate danger, or maybe you're outside of that war, you can look back on that kind of fondly.
And it's interesting too, because it's not Stockholm syndrome with Lawrence or anything like that. Like, it's a genuine, like, maybe he's a rather unique man, but he doesn't he's not brainwashed at all. He knows exactly what's happening, and he can have enough moral, you know, compassion to be like, I hate that this is happening this whole time, you know?
Yeah. It's like, he's never letting anyone off the hook either. It's specifically like, I'm telling you why they're doing it. Even when Yanoi forces them to observe Gyo, where they need to fast and everything. And he's just explaining to him what it is. And he's like, if you do it, he'll do it. This is his understanding. Like, he thinks that it's a cure for laziness. And if you stop feeding the laziness, it'll go away. He's like, do you believe that? He's like, I don't know what I believe, but I know what he believes. And I'm telling you, that's what it is. And yeah, he's not making any excuses for his behavior or for what the Japanese are doing. He's just saying, like, this is why they're doing it.
Yeah, like, play the game and don't try to, like, you know, get out alive, play the game, and we know this is wrong. And also, it's interesting, too, because you wonder, like, where did Lawrence get this Japanese, not, like, yeah, like, we talked before, like, did he study it, you know, back in England? Did he pick it up? that sort of thing, because he understands very well how they work. So how did he figure that out? But nobody else seems to know how to infiltrate that. But it is, but because he is a special man.
Yeah, I think that he genuinely believes that if they all understand each other, they won't fight anymore. It's apparent that he was in Japan. You know, when he tells a story about, was it Shanghai?
Mm.
Was he just in the military to travel and to learn these things at the same time? Yeah, I don't know. I find that, like, his character is so fascinating just by...
Right.
I think that's great about not giving him those flashbacks and just letting the story tell his story.
Because he was talking to Captain Yanoi, and he says something like about, I think, 1936, and Yanoi was in Manchuria,
mm-hmm.
and Lawrence was in Tokyo, right?
Yeah.
Like, you don't know also how long Yanoi's been away from Japan, or how long some of these people have been displaced from their homes, or, like, I think they say Selyers was fighting in India, right?
Yeah.
I think so, yeah.
Like, you know, you just sort of feel like these people have all been pushed far, far away from home, and they're all stuck in Java together.
Right, which is the saddest thing. It's like you're in paradise, you're in a beautiful place, you're taking over somebody else's home, you know, the people of Java, to make your own, like, a war on this beautiful paradise, and it, like, and that's why nothing makes sense after a while, because they don't know who they are, and they're trying to, yeah, it's just, it's so well placed together, especially just with the beautiful settings, you know?
Yeah, and it's pure imperialism, and, like, the fact that we never see any actual native of Java, that it's just, these are two opposing forces on completely almost neutral territory is also kind of fascinating. It only works because it is this, like I said, this almost like memory of something that is on this exotic location for both sides. That isn't Japan. That isn't even Okinawa. That isn't anything that the Japanese are used to. And you know, they make point to tell, you know, how, again, like how if he was in Manchuria, he's far from home, they're far from home. This is almost like a dream that exists in a completely different part of the world, and none of them ever go back there again. You know, seeing the soldiers wave to Sellier's head, you know, as they're all being shuffled off to work on that airstrip. What would you do if you just saw, you know, would you say goodbye? You know, I don't know. It's so, like I said, it's so dream and memory like that. It's so surreal.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of those images do pop out at you like a dream, or have this sort of unreality of a dream. Like even when Sellier's is in the cell and David Bowie's doing the routine of like shaving as a mime.
Yeah.
I heard on some talk show a while ago where like David Bowie was on the talk show and talking about, before I was a musician, I was studying to be a mime, except I was the kind of mime who talked and everyone laughs.
Yeah.
You can see it right there.
Yeah.
What the routine would have been. And it's fantastic, but you know, it feels very unreal. Or when they tie him up for the firing squad and they fire and he's fine. Like there's something sort of dreamlike, or even just in images, like when he's buried up to his head in sand and the moth lands on him mm-hmm. in the moonlight. You know, it's something about that pops out and just doesn't feel entirely real, but it kind of sticks with you the way an image from a dream might.
That's interesting, too, that, you know, Oshima could make such horrible things look like a dream and not a nightmare. Mm-hmm. And because these things did happen and they're war crimes, and yet he made them sort of lyrical and beautiful, which, yeah, wow. That's a really, and the fact that is from his own cultural perspective that he's doing that. He's trying to, you know, show some sort of beauty on that anyway. It's a really beautiful perspective.
I mean, and like the emotional linchpin of this film, of like that final scene, like Takashi does, you know, at the time did not speak English.
I mean, the way he says Merry Christmas and you see the look in his eyes, like the words almost don't matter. It's just like the emotion he's putting behind them that really carries it and makes you feel something. Like, you know, Merry Christmas in this film doesn't necessarily mean Christmas in the way that this episode's going to be released on. It means Christmas as in, you know, that night I got drunk and saved your life, and, you know, remember the good times we had and remember everything between us. Like, that's what Christmas means in this film.
Yeah, and that's like what Christmas is, you know, from that moment on until his, you know, apparent execution. Like, that's Christmas for Hara. too, is just that, like, remember, that was a very good Christmas. That was a very good night. And, like, had he lived, that's what he always would have thought of on Christmas. And I'm sure, you know, you get the impression that for the rest of his life, Lawrence will always remember that, you know, is that was his Christmas at the same time, you know?
Yeah, it's like, you know, Christmas is about, you know, peace and love. But, I mean, he showed mercy on that day. Hara did. So, I mean, he did. He showed peace. He offered Christmas and he didn't even know what it was about. So that's quite beautiful where he didn't even understand what he was doing. And he you know, exercised the true spirit of Christmas. And that is lovely, even though obviously he's a devout Buddhist. And especially even that scene where when David Bowie wrecks the altar, for a Japanese director to just be like, all right, let's trash it all. That's incredibly disrespectful. What he does, and like it's just, and he sits there, doesn't move while he's breaking everything. It's like, yeah.
I don't think any other director really could have pulled that off either. And again, if people are listening or familiar with Oshima, he was such a critic of Japan as well. Like he was, you know, for him to even make this like truly international film, like he, looking back, he's like he was very anti-nationalist. He relished, you know, internationalism and people learning from each other. And, you know, even in the realm of the senses, the other one of his films that you've seen, Leanne, you know, he went through a French production company because, you know, you still can't see that movie in its entirety in Japan, uncensored. So he seemed like a very early adopter of, like, you know, thinking outside of Japan and like really wanting to know what the rest of the world believed. And, you know, in Death by Hanging, you know, when he talks about Koreans, not with derision, but like, even as like an ethnic minority and people that are treated poorly. And like, he's like, why are they treated poorly? Like, why are we thinking these things? And why are we committing crimes? Or why are we doing these things? And like, it's the dream that's broken, not us. And I love that about Oshima so much. He's just he continued to be subversive through his entire life. Even when you'd see him on Iron Chef, you're like, oh man, that guy's on Iron Chef right now.
I didn't know he was on Iron Chef.
Oh yeah, look up on YouTube. You can watch all the old Japanese Iron Chefs. Like, he's a guest judge on like probably 10% of them. It's awesome, and he's always wearing like a full kimono.
It's like realizing Takashi Kitano's on the Most Extreme Elimination Challenge, the Takashi's Castle. Like,
yeah,
when you finally
yeah.
make the connection, like, oh, that's him.
Well, yeah, I'd known that show before. I mean, you know, like the Most Extreme Elimination Challenge in like America, like when I first
funny
saw
dubbed release, yeah,
I first saw like Battle Royale before I saw Hanabi, and I was just like, oh my god, that's that same guy. That's so great. Like, and I think that like, yeah, I don't know. There's something so dark about him, even watching that show, like, oh my god, this is so mean.
Well, and like, Kitano's one of those guys where you just keep finding out new things about him. Like, I don't know, have you seen the video of him tap dancing?
No.
Yes.
Like, he's a brilliant tap dancer, and like, he's just one of those people.
I sometimes like to think of like Kitano as like, if either of you are familiar with Takashi Miike.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I almost feel like Kitano is... And I like some Miike films. I just feel like if Miike had a real artistic streak and like natural talent, right, then like that's what like he can take all those really subversive ideas and those really nihilistic viewpoints of his and focus it into something really interesting and beautiful. I think that's something that Miike has really yet to hit on. I think his first three films, the that Black Society trilogy, is the closest thing to that. But Kitano has that way. I think, you know, he has what?
Well, even just the way he'll like apply, like for instance, his comedic timing. You know, like some of the deadpan stuff, like
Getting any?
Oh, well, oh, like yeah. in the non-comedy films, like what's the one where he's got the bouquet of flowers and it, like the gun just goes off and it's like the most deadpan thing I've ever seen. But
oh, you I know, think the that's film's in Sonatine. Or Sonatine. No, he, okay. Boiling or, Point. He has the big bouquet and it goes off in the what is it? The elevator or something?
I think it's when he shows up to kill the guy.
Oh yeah, yeah.
It's just like it goes off at the wrong time and it's like a perfect comic timed moment, but he's just applying it in a place where you would never expect to see that. And I don't, I always feel a little bit bad talking about this film because you have four great leads, and three of them are basically icons, and then there's Tom Conti, who, like, you know, has so much work to do, and I'm glad we talked about him as much as we have. But
he's the ultimate straight man, like, in this film. Yeah. Like, he's got to be the one, you know, not crying at the funeral. He's got to be the one, like, holding everyone together and like, no, we are making a film, everybody. Like, right. This is a movie.
And that's the thing. He's really, like, the best. He steals every scene in this movie. Like,
he's great. Oh, yeah.
He's so charming and lovely. And actually, like, I wrote about this. I wrote an essay in this on Pinland Empire for Christmas. And I sent it to Tom Conti just for, like, the heck of it. And he actually wrote me back. The sweetest man. He's like, you know, you certainly understood the picture. Thank you. And I wish you well. And, like, he didn't have to read that. He didn't have to take the time out. And, like, he did. So sweet of him. Like, thank you, Tom Conti. Like, you made my life, basically, you know. But, yeah, like, he is, like, that character actor that people, like, know, but they don't know. Like, a lot of American, like, well, I'll tell them about, like, this movie. They're like, I don't know anything about this movie. And I'm like, okay, you know who Tom Conti is if you've seen the television show Friends, because he plays Ross's father-in-law. This bumbling British guy. And they're like, oh, yeah, I know that guy. He's really funny. And, you know, but that Tom Conti's in, like, a billion different things. And he's just that good, straight man, really great character actor who doesn't get the accolades. And he's the main character of this film. And yet everybody wants, you know, a lot of people are like, oh, Bowie. He's always on the cover art, you know?
Right.
He's like the face and everyone else is the hair that's perfectly framing his face. It's like a great haircut.
He's had so few starring roles. Like, I almost always think of him in these, like, little bit parts or supporting parts. You know, like, he even shows up in Paddington 2 earlier this year. But
this, like, is like his meta
he's
film.
The lead,
like,
of the
he's
film.
Always,
like,
he's always Mr. Lawrence. The same way that, like, Beatrice Dahl is always going to be Betty Blue. Like, I don't care how many other great movies she makes. Like, she's always Betty Blue. And I don't know if you guys have ever, I'm sure you've heard that, you know, Jeremy Irons turned down the role of Lawrence because he said it seemed too gay or there were too many homosexual undertones to the film. And he, like, always regretted not taking that film.
Serves him right.
But I can't imagine this film without Tom Conti.
I can't
imagine Jeremy Irons in this film.
No, I think Jeremy Irons might have come across, like, too harsh or cold. Like, Tom Conti, there's, like, a real warmth to him in his, especially his interactions with Takashi Kitano, like, when they're just kind of both sitting there with their legs crossed, hunched over, talking back and forth. Like, you know, I can't really picture Jeremy Irons or, like, you know, somebody who comes across a little bit more, I don't know, formal.
Yeah, like,
doing the same thing, yeah.
The, I don't know, the casualness of him, like, when he's, like, you know, he's strung up on that pole and, you know, Sellers comes to save him. And he's like, okay, we're going to go walkies now. And he's all, like, a crumpled mess. And it's hilarious because just that expression is just completely silly. But, you know,
you can't even see him and you can just hear his voice go, like, it's not for you. They've come for me.
Right. And exactly. Like, yeah. It's hilarious that he, you know, that they're trying to keep it somewhat light in this most horrible of situations. And that's really funny. And yeah, Irons is not, he's scary, but he's not funny.
But I mean, again, maybe that's because, like, we never got to see him in this film too. Like, and, like, Tom Conti, like, owns this film. Like, this is his character. Like, you can, you know, this obviously isn't, like, a movie slated for remake anytime soon, I'm sure. And if you're listening to this podcast, please don't do it. But yeah.
No.
But yeah, like, he embodies that so much. Like, every other character, like, every other actor in this movie, like, embodies that character so much. Bowie's physicality and even the two different color eyes when you see him, like, that's part of what makes Yanoi so obsessed with him, I think. You know, that strangeness that,
well, like, when they say, you know, are you a devil, are you a demon, like, you know, David Bowie with those wild eyes, like, it doesn't sound so far out. Like, I could believe he's a devil, you know. Like, it's not
It's almost like more magical realism than it is like fantasy. Yeah.
Right. Like, you know, David Bowie, of course, has that otherworldly quality. That's why he's, you know, Man Who Fell to Earth, or that's why he's in Labyrinth, or those types of roles.
Or you can imagine him as like Tesla, you know, in
The
Prestige. Yeah.
That was a great bit of casting.
Yeah.
I think, you know, or just like Takashi Kitano again, the way he kind of like hunches over when he has to apologize for setting Sellers and Lawrence free and he's just like, sir, I was a little drunk, and like, he's so...
Yeah, even as he's being punished, like, you know, he says, like, you'll be without sake, and he just kind of, like, giggles for a minute, like, he's like, yeah, I know what I did, that's me, you got me.
Because him and his little cabin full of sake, like, that's not a punishment.
Yeah.
Go to your room and no video games.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, there's something also very, like, I think it's the fact that you have those, like, schoolboy flashbacks and the building, it might have been a school because, like, there are, I think, chalkboards, right? You see sort of in the background at several times. Like, it has that kind of, oh, the principal's going to catch you and, you know, give you a hit with the stick sort of quality to it in a weird way. Like, there is sort of a schoolboy thing going
on. Yeah, that's an interesting parallel to the flashbacks, too. Like, you know, it makes me think that it was probably like a missionary of some kind where you have the church and you have the school and these like classic, especially Western examples of authority that are, you know, all of these Western soldiers are being kept in line by Japanese forces, but still so prevalently like around these symbols of, you know, Western authority. I think it's kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. Oh, have either of you seen video of Oshima's funeral?
No, I don't think so.
It's a bummer, but it's like Ryuichi Sakamoto stood there, like he eulogized him and said, you know, I would be nothing without him, and he is so responsible for who I am. And they carried Oshima through the streets playing the theme of Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence. And like his funeral was built like this, like the set of The Ceremony, another one of his films, but the theme of Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence was so prevalent in his funeral. And like, I think that also says so much about what it meant to both of them, you know?
Yeah. I mean, and even Tom Conti, he got this was like his second big film role, I guess. Okay. Bowie was already huge, so it didn't do much for him, but you know, I mean, everybody else, it did. I mean, in a way, this is like unknown to Bowie people. I've noticed that casual Bowie fans are just like, no, it's like the Bowie fan who hasn't listened to Low yet, you know, which is fine, which I get, you know, I'm not a criticism. I only got into it like 2 years ago and I decided to sit down. I said, I'm going to learn this album finally. And I was like, oh my God, it's amazing. But you know, so it's one of those things where it's a deep cut.
But like, even in that, like, I think that interview that we all watched, if anyone hasn't seen that thing on YouTube with, Bowie and YMO, and oh Takashi, like
talk show, yeah.
Oh yeah. Whenever like Bowie talks about this stuff, you know, I think his connection with music and like his interest in world music and kind of learning seems very earnest to him. And like he had already been familiar with Oshima's films. Like he's also very clearly familiar with Yellow Magic Orchestra and Ryuichi Sakamoto in general, like his music. And like, mm-hmm. like I said, like it feels earnest. And I think that's very much in the spirit of the movie in that same way. Like, you know, we talked about Hara and Lawrence being, you know, very earnest participants in exchange between one another. And I think that's kind of the point of the film, you know, that constant theme of like, nobody's right, we're all wrong. Kind of thing. And I think that like, he was such a good like meta choice for that no one else could have done that in that same way.
It's true, because, yeah, I mean, I do see him, but I also do see Selliers at the same time, which is a very strange mm-hmm. trick. Sometimes I'm like, no, he's totally this poor, you know, guy who's getting all beat up and stuff. And then I'm like, no, that's David Bowie, because when you see those eyes,
yeah,
you know, so you see the rock star and then you don't. So because he was an unusual man, and he was such a unique person anyway. So, it's not stunt casting or anything, but it worked very, very well.
No, it's that weird sort of middle territory of he both embodies that character, but you never entirely forget that it's David Bowie. It's like a version of David Bowie that's just been incarnated in this scenario somehow.
Which is perfect for him, because that was him. I mean, for so many years, he, you know, embodied a character for, you know, with the man to felt
Thin White
Duke,
Earth. I mean, like any of those characters he sort of became for a little while. Until the next one.
Yeah, until like the 90s or something, and then he just was like, I'm myself and this is who I am. But for so long, he lived in other people's lives, you know, so.
Yeah, and like you said, like stunt casting seems like the wrong way to put it.
Mm-hmm.
where it's just it's a kind of casting, like it totally serves the film that it's him. I think he grows from being that character at the same time to explore more of, you know, himself. And like this film and like, you know, Oshima in general were like very instrumental in Takashi becoming Takashi, you know, and like really, you know, pushing himself forward. And like, you know, we talked about Tom Conti and, you know, what we got out of this film from, you know, watching him. And then, I don't know, I'm sure the guy, you know, the other captain with the mustache, I'm sure he went on to too. This meant a lot to him. Yeah, I'm sure like this meant a whole lot to him as well. And like, it's, you know, I the same thing, like I can't imagine watching this film and not growing from it in the same way.
Yeah, and I mean, and also, I mean, this is probably like rewatching this, I don't know, like, you know, sixth time or something over the years. And, you know, the very last scene where, you know, Lawrence says goodbye to Hara, and I choked up, and I never really cried from that scene before. And I was like, my God, it's really just so tragic. They're buddies. You almost see them as little boys, like, you know, because they're both very like baby faced and all that, and it's just like
make eye contact like the way they
sort of
and they're keeping their heads low. And
Hara's kind of like, you know, I don't know, squishing his hand or like fabric like on the bed or whatever, you know, that kind of thing. They're both really nervous and they can't look at each other, and it's like they just want to hug, and they just want to be like, we're buddies, we're brothers, and we're not, because we've ripped each other apart. And it's just, yeah, it really got to me. So I mean, I think when you've seen something so many times and you revisit it, that it shows how well the themes were done together, and the, you know, just the naturalness of this, that it can still, you know, make you feel, make you think things over the years. It's really just a brilliant film.
Raw. Yeah, I this movie, I don't know, I feel like I get very emotional every time I see this movie, and it's that, I think it is that nostalgia and that, you know, overarching feeling of regret that you get by, I don't know, watching people that don't know what to say to each other. Like, I don't know, like, again, like his Sellier's flashback, you know, and like this, you know, before my grandma died, I remember she said that like she always wished she could have gone to Hawaii. Like, while she was still living, I was like, well, let's try to go to Hawaii. Like, you should try to do that. Like, she's like, nah, yeah, I'm too old, I can't do it. And I don't know why. Like, I always felt bad that my grandma never got to go to Hawaii. I don't know why that always kind of stuck with me in this weird way of like, I don't know what she would have gotten for it or anything, but just like that she lived 96 years, and like by, you know, or, you know, she didn't get to finish high school when she was a kid. Like, that, for some reason, like, really stuck with me of like, you've lived such a long life. And those were things that you always wish that you could have done. And it's past the point in your life where you feel like you can accomplish them. So all you have is that regret. Like, there's no way to ever fix that, or there's no way to ever like repair that regret. And I think that's what regret actually is, like, as opposed to like envy or like just general wantingness, is like regret is, you can't repair that.
Fix. Yeah.
Yeah. It's, you couldn't fix it if you wanted to,
you know. That's that goes through the entire film, from the, you know, flashback or that sort of reverie he has with his younger brother putting the hand on him, right up to the epilogue. Like, it's that's sort of central to the film.
Yeah
I mean, for war movies, I think this is a very interesting one for most people to see. Like, my dad's a big, you know, war movie guy, you know, and I was like, no, you gotta, my dad's even like a Thin Red Line guy, even though he's not a Terrence Malick guy. Right. So I'm like, he'll watch anything that's about the war. And I think this one's a really interesting one, because there's no fighting in it. There's no valor, but it's quite entertaining. You have, you know, there is violence, because it is a war movie, but, you know, it definitely, because of the charm of Tom Conti and stuff, it's a movie that can suck people in, and it's really like worthwhile to watch. I wish it was put more into the scope of World War II classic films. And because it is, I guess, somewhat in, you know, half in Japanese, whatever, it's not, but it really should be, because it's very accessible film, you know?
I think that's something that we haven't even touched on at all. Like, when we've kind of gone into these themes, is that, yeah, Leanne, you're that kind of hit it spot on of like how accessible this film is to people and like how easy it is to just kind of like, you know, you talked about how emotional kind of you felt at the end and like how emotional it makes me feel. Like this is something that's like very easy to kind of approach and it, but still, you know, makes you feel so much. And I don't think that that those kind of films happen very often.
No, I think it's pretty rare. It's, you know, it's the sort of film you end up coming away more with the feeling than sort of a clear statement. You know, I think that's good. It's sort of a film that can grow on you and you can find new things in and mean different things to you depending how you watch it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, you know, you could probably hit this movie in a weird time in your life and sure. it would, you know, mean something totally different, you know, to you.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I was introduced to it like when I was in grad school, we were talking about like intercultural communication and the teacher was like, okay, we're watching this. So that was the only reason that, I mean, I came upon it. It was just like one of those things. And so when I was dealing with it, I don't know, not like 15 years ago or whatever, you know, it was very different than what I'm seeing now. So yeah, it definitely like grows with you. So it works on multiple watchings too, which is great, you know?
I mean, that's a good entry point, just coming at it through the cultural communication, because like you really get a sense of how it's more than just the linguistic barrier, like, you know, understanding on sort of a deeper level, like, you know, again, like how great is it when Tom Conti, when he's visiting Takashi Kitano at the end and gives them the bow, like he doesn't have to bow to him, like he's, you know, the war's over and it's like purely just a genuine gesture of respect to him. It's not,
yeah,
like it's not just some empty cultural gesture, you know, that he picked up on to help him survive in the camp. Like he really means it. Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that kind of all sums it up pretty well.
Yeah. So if folks want to follow you online, where can they check out?
I'm on Twitter at Liana Marie K, and if you want to read my essay, go to Pinland Empire and look up Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence, a movie for Christmas. That was about 4 years ago, but you can still find it there. So yeah, and we can chat about this and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at rzachary. It's mostly just swear words these days. But you can, I guess I work for a company called Retrotainment. So if you're ever interested in like retro video games or anything, you can check out Retrotainment HQ on Twitter or retrotainment.com. And see more of my work and what we do there.
And if folks want to follow the show, it's over on flixwiz.com or at flixwiz on Twitter. Merry Christmas, listeners, and until next time, take care.